My name is Vern Reakey. I live in Seattle, Washington. I have for 30 years, it seems not that long, but it's been 30 years, I've been teaching in the School of Law at the University of Washington. Before that, I was a real lawyer for a while. I am now what people politely refer to as an academic lawyer. Among other courses, I teach a course in family law. I also am the principal draftsman of the marriage and divorce law of the state of Washington. Not that I had my own way with it altogether. The legislature had something to say about that. But at least part of the work, a major part of it, I must bear the responsibility for. I want to talk about that with you tonight.
Why?
In the hopes of getting some information from you.
I'm joking.
Because the Dissolution Act started that way. We made a draft, and I did this with 150 people for 3 days. There were two other lawyers present, and the other 147 people were just like you from various parts, and we drafted what seemed to that 147, 150, if you want to count the lawyers, people to be a good Dissolution Act. And took it to the legislature, and it became law in 1973. Since that time, I have been trying to evaluate what has happened because of the change in our Marriage Dissolution Act. And thank you for the question. I always appreciate the opportunity to ask people in the communities questions about it, because it is helpful. Lawyers are perhaps not the right group to decide whether or not dissolution is being properly handled or not. There are now in the neighborhood of 30,000 dissolutions of marriage a year in the state of Washington. And if you figure as modest an amount as $200 per case, that's $6 million in lawyer fees. And there is something in the books about not sending the cat out to get the cream. I'd like to start by saying what this discussion, as I see it, is not about. There is a problem, of course, of what's wrong with our marriages today. It's a fascinating subject. At least 30% of our marriages are ending in dissolution, and very close to another 30% of them are resulting in separations which never become formalized. So something like 60% of all of our marriages are not performing the way that they should. If I owned a car that failed to start 6 times out of 10, I'd take it to the garage. But that's not the subject I want to talk about tonight, although, as I say, it certainly is a fascinating one, and it's one that deserves very careful attention. I've usually had pretty good luck when I've gone to this state legislature with proposals to amend our Dissolution Act. I've had absolutely miserable luck when I've gone to the legislature with proposals to amend our Marriage Act. And perhaps there's a lesson there of some sort. I don't really want to get into that subject of how do we go about promoting better marriages, despite the fact, as I've just indicated, that I think our present system is really abysmal. Our licensing laws are terrible, not only in this state, but in other states. They tried to screen for the wrong things. Obviously, our courtship practices in the United States have almost become non-functioning. When one examines, as I have been doing in the last few years, the duration of marriages, for example, and find now that the average marriage lasts less than 5 years, and that a very substantial percentage of them are over in 2 years, there's something wrong with courtship. People are not preparing themselves for marriage in a way that makes it possible to have expectations realistically of something that will function well. But as I say, that's a subject, fascinating as it is, that I really don't want to get into. Nor do I see the Dissolution Act and the fact that it occurs in court as being related it very closely at all to protection of marriages. It's not a very interesting subject to talk about criminal laws like adultery and bigamy, and I don't even find much fascination in civil actions which are designed to protect marriages, like alienation of affection and criminal conversation. If you don't know what that means, it simply proves the point that they have become dead letters so long that I can't remember when a prosecuting attorney in this state or anywhere else for that matter that I know of brought an action for adultery or bigamy. They simply do not function. And I don't think that's related to the question of how we should go about dissolving marriages. I think that's another problem. I suppose that the questions about reconciliation of people who have fallen on evil days in their marriage is a closer question. And maybe one has to think about that somewhat. Is there something in the fact that we dissolve marital relations in court which is counterproductive in terms of helping people reconcile? That's a problem, I think, that we at least have to think about. We have private and public reconciliation agencies operating in our state. Their batting average is dismal, just plain dismal, if you count reconciliation as being the objective being sought. If you think of those counseling agencies as being agencies which help people to work out a better transition from married life to single life, then one can say something more optimistic about them. They seem to be useful in that connection. But reconciliation as such, one is almost left with the feeling that by the time that a client walks in to see an attorney, or at the time that they separate, the spouses separate, that maybe the real probabilities of reconciliation have been fairly well exhausted. And what we're left with is a question of how to go about the process of unwinding the relationship in a way which is most useful for all of the interests that are involved. So, narrowing our focus to that question, you know, is that process of dissolution after the split has come and after the separation and after we've fanned out trying to work a reconciliation, is the courtroom a good place to try and do that? Now, I think maybe it would be helpful to us to spend maybe 3 or 4 or 5 minutes examining the question, how did we ever get in the courts with this problem in the first place? Maybe history can teach us a little bit. Well, of course, it hasn't been very many centuries ago that this was not a law problem at all. The church in Europe, of course, handled dissolutions of marriage. There weren't very many. The divorce, as we know it today, or the dissolution of marriage, used to be called the divorce a vinculo, means simply cutting the chains, the bonds, almost didn't exist for practical purposes. What did exist were so-called annulments. You could, if you went at it correctly, have the church announce that you had never been validly married, and it wasn't a cutting of the bonds, because the church felt that what God had put together, man ought not put asunder. So they didn't put asunder very often. They spent most of their time erasing it and saying it never happened. Now, the grounds were, of course, somewhat limited. There had to be some kind of a fraud or a mental incompetence or some other impediment to the formation of the status, the relationship. The contract, I would like to say that with a rising inflection. Was it a contract of marriage? We've spent a lot of time and energy trying to decide for ourselves what a marriage really is. Sometimes it's called a sacrament. Rather interesting that, as I understand the historical theology that was involved, the sacrament of marriage was one that was administered by the participants to each other, while the clergy person was there to be kind of a, I don't mean to be disparaging, a kind of a master of ceremonies. Something fairly close to a contract, but it was nonetheless, as the church conceived of it at that earlier point, thought of as being sacramental, and so you had a different kind of a problem. And then things began to happen. There was, of course, a man fairly well known to many of us in this room, Martin Luther, who decided that marriage really wasn't the sacrament. It rather was a contract, now maybe a very special kind of a contract, but it was one that could be dissolved or set aside by courts. And some of you may not know, but by the mid-1600s in northern Saxony, divorce of marriage was available in the courts on demand. There were no grounds. If you wanted to be divorced, you simply went into the appropriate public official and told them that you wanted to be divorced and signed the papers, and that was it. On the other hand, in England, the nation from which we've drawn the common law, the pattern was spelling out a little bit differently. The church, of course, remained pretty much in place in England until Henry VIII, and then they didn't really have so much of a reformation as Europe did. Henry VIII kind of picked up the Pope and moved him over and slid himself in place. And Henry became not only the head of the state, but also the head of the church, the defender of the faith and all of the rest of those good things in his title. Now, his reasons for that were varied and quite numerous. I'm not talking about all eight of them, or even more. The church and the secular government were, of course, locked in battle through all of that point. This is the time when the Pope was trying to get kings to stand barefooted in the snow outside, you know, petitioning the church for clemency, and the state was returning the favor with enthusiasm whenever it had the upper hand. You know your history probably better than I do. Well, the result was that Henry, as the head of the church as well as the state, took over the marriage dissolution business. And he gave it to not his secular court people, but to his church court people. The chancellors became the people who were in the divorcing business. And it wasn't until about 1753 that courts got into the divorce business in England. In the meantime, the chancellors were doing some business, and when they began to get a little bit restless, you remember the English kings had a little bit of difficulty with some of their chancellors. And so the Parliament began to grant bills of divorcement. That is, the Parliament directly enacted acts, statutes, which divorced people. In 1888, in the territory of Oregon, in a case known as Maynard against Hill, those of you who are history buffs of this part of the world may remember good old Doc Maynard, of Seattle fame. Doc Maynard rode the wagons west, and he finally wound up, he left his wife and child in Ohio, he rode the wagons west, met a widow on the wagon train, came out here and married her. He had promised to bring his wife and child out from Ohio as soon as he got enough property. He once owned half of what is now Seattle, that seemed like enough. He didn't send for his wife, she decided to come. And Doc went around happily announcing the fact that the folks in Seattle were going to see something new, a man with a wife on each arm. Then he decided that wasn't such a red-hot idea, so he went down to the legislature in the territory and got an enactment of the territory of Oregon, granting him a bill of divorce. And they did it just the way the legislature enacts any other statute. They didn't bother telling Mrs. Maynard about it. They did. The first one. They simply enacted the statute. And, they didn't bother holding a hearing or giving her notice or anything of the sort. It was regarded as being something that the state had just completely taken over. Now, see what has happened here. What was originally a matter of religious, theological, sacred concern became, by a rather gradual tradition, something which had become so completely secularized that it could be handled by the legislature. While it was awkward, cumbersome, expensive, slow, and everything else to have to go down and lobby your divorce through the legislature. So when Washington was formed, and this happened in many other states, the constitution of this state, some other states the same, and in all states, at least legislation, simply gave the power to grant divorces to the courts. The problem we have to ask ourselves is whether or not that was a good idea, or whether or not the matter of terminating marriages should be somewhere else, some other kind of a process. No. All right, that's a long introduction to the subject, but I thought maybe it was necessary to get at it that way. I'd like to know from you now, what do we want to accomplish by so-called marriage dissolution? Why do we do it at all? What's the reason for it?
Did I get lost somewhere? What is dissolution?
Dissolution is the name that's now used instead of divorce. You don't dissolve people, you dissolve marriages. You used to divorce people. It's a little different, but it's the process now by which we terminate marriages. It's called dissolution of the marriage relationship.
I don't think they use the word termination. I don't see how you can dissolve a relationship that exists.
It would be a good word.
It'd be much better.
Do you think that's really what it's all about?
What?
Just sort of terminating the relationship?
No, you can't.
You don't think you can terminate the relationship?
Not if there's children involved or anybody else involved, because it doesn't just involve two people.
It involves the children and anybody else. You got a husband and wife, of course.
Husband and wife and in-laws and sister-in-laws and brother-in-laws.
Whole family structure.
Yes, they're all involved.
I agree with you. And I would even throw in the state. The state has an interest.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
The state has all kinds of interests, in fact. You know, we've always thought of the family as being the place, for example, where children are reared, where the education really starts. Those of us who are in the education business often feel that what happens in the first 6 years or 5 years of a child's life is probably more significant than what happens in the next 15 in terms of the child's attitudes and ability to learn and malnutrition and all the rest of those things. You know, we've depended upon families for this, so it's pretty important. And yet you come to the place where, for reasons which are significant to these persons, they've come to the end of the road. And they're either going to just plain leave each other, and as I've already indicated, that's happening far more frequently than you think it is, just separations, or else they're formalizing it and going through to a divorce. Well, if we are faced head on with that problem, what do we want out of it? You know, what's a good one? When I was in the Air Force, they told me that any landing that I could walk away from was a good one. Not always very smooth, but how about a dissolution of marriage? What do you want out of it? Yes, ma'am.
I think when you dissolve a marriage, what you want is you're dissolving the legal bind that you have with each other so that you can get on with your lives. I mean, if you just walk away from the relationship with no kind of formal termination, then you've always got, I mean, there would be no end to it. You could never go on and do something else and be something else. You would always have that something hanging in the background, and it would be really hard on the two people involved.
Lots of loose ends.
Too many.
Name a few, will you?
Name a few.
Children.
All right, that's a good one. Who's going to support them? Who's going to care for them? A whole big bag full. Talk about that tomorrow morning a little bit.
Property.
Now, who owns the car? Who owns the house?
Legal responsibility for each other.
For each other and for debts and those things have been incurred historically, just sort of winding up, may I call it, the business?
Yeah, they're stupid little things, like who's going to pay off the Penny's charge account, you know? things like that have to be decided.
Yeah.
It may sound cruel and it may sound...
But it's got to be done.
Yeah, it has to be done. You know?
It's very much like the probate of an estate.
Yeah.
It simply has to be done, all right? What else? Anybody else have any ideas?
Child support,
certainly so.
Now, who's going to keep the family home? Who's going to reside in
property.
The family?
Division of property.
You can't marry again.
Whether or not you can marry again, that's right. Unless you get the first title cleared up, you can't sell the boat again. If we think of it in those terms, you see, that's where we're coming down. Do you people see where you're going? Everything you said so far.
I can solve the whole thing.
The whole thing meaning?
Don't get divorced.
Don't get married.
Don't get married.
Oh, well, I'm not going that far.
I wondered if you would.
Well, what happened?
You know, today in the United States, we are involved, whether we want it or not, we are involved in a massive experiment with this thing. There are 800 times more people living together without marriage in the United States today than there were 15 years ago. Now, that's still not very many. It's only about 3 or 4% of all the people who are living together are living together without being married. But in terms of growth and expansion, it's happening much more rapidly than it did before. Now, why in the world do you suppose people would want to live together without getting married? I mean a man and a woman living
together.
Because
they're a couple of cheapskates.
Responsibility.
Most of them have been married and divorced.
Cheapskates.
Well, they're trying to avoid, like she said, responsibility.
They think. What kind of responsibility?
Oh, just hit today and gone tomorrow and there are no bonds, etc. They hope.
People do that in marriage all the time.
You suppose that unmarried cohabitation is a more successful pattern of relating than married cohabitation?
Not necessarily.
In some cases.
They have the same emotional entanglement.
They sure do.
Exactly.
Do you suppose that if you went to a marriage counseling agency in Minneapolis or Chicago or someplace, that you would find couples coming in for marriage counseling who have never been married?
Yes.
Do you suppose that you would find as many unmarried people coming in for marriage counseling? May I use that term? You know, relationship counseling. Percentage-wise, as you would find out of percentage-wise out of married people?
Maybe more.
How do people who are living together and have been living together for a year or two, how do they end their relationship?
Painfully.
Painfully, you bet you painfully. Yes, sir.
They also frequently have the same problems as ending a marriage. They have property which they hold in common often, and they have to figure out some way to dissolve that, and they don't have recourse to the courts except through a lengthy process, much more difficult than dissolution.
Sometimes there are children involved in that.
Maybe children. We haven't said anything yet about the Form 1040. Or property
That's
taxes.
That's property.
Or citizenship, or you know, lots of things like this. Or right to exemption from claims of creditors, or inheritance. There are literally hundreds of these issues popping around. You've all heard, of course, of Marvin against Marvin, the cohabitation case. Maybe you don't know that at the time that that case went to trial, there were roughly 3,000 such cases involving unmarried cohabitants waiting for trial in California.
But that withdrew a bunch of them.
It may very well have chilled the process, but the problems won't go away.
Yeah.
And as you've been demonstrating, the problems, you see, are there. Everything you've given me so far, I think, are either child care or economic issues. Are there any other kind of problems that occur to you?
Many.
Emotional. Spiritual.
Spiritual. Maybe you know, maybe you don't know. 6 out of 10 murders in the United States are in the family.
Yeah.
You know, people don't kill strangers very often. It takes somebody who's there day after day, needling and needling and needling. There are a few murders and robberies and that kind of thing, but the great bulk of murders involve persons who know each other well. To murder a stranger is a relatively small thing, a rare thing, and most of them do occur in the family. Tremendous psychological problems.
We say that what we are really asking the courts to do is to recognize a condition that exists. What I'm getting at is this. If either the husband or the wife, or the man or the woman, I guess you're using the wrong terms, are unfaithful, they have dissolved that wedding in God's sight. And it seems to me that what we're asking the courts to do is to recognize, there's probably a legal term for it, the condition that prevails. And if you can imagine a situation where in reality, maybe we've touched on that, the marriage has not been dissolved by unfaithfulness. The situation would be some physical or other situation. Then in God's sight, they're still married, and you'd have to seek some other remedy for it. Am I off the beam on that?
If I understand your observation, what you're saying is that if it's an accomplished fact...
Yeah. Fait accompli.
We might just as well write it off.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
I mean, so one has sinned a little, there's always forgiveness. What happened to the spiritual part of this thing?
Do you have that amount of forgiveness in you?
Sometimes it's better to try to save the boat than sink it.
It creates... The comments you're making now put very nicely the next thing that I think we've got to think about a little bit. It's one possibility is to say there's, as far as the status itself is concerned, there's nothing to litigate anymore. The status now, whether or not they're married to each other. That's either happened or it's not happened. And you just recognize it. Or you can say, no, that's something we've got to litigate about. Now, until 1970, that's very recent for you if you think about it. You litigated that question, theoretically. You had to have grounds for divorce. Everyone, of course, always talked about adultery and non-support. But adultery and non-support were almost never the grounds for divorce. In almost Ivory Snow proportion. 94.6 or whatever it is. The grounds were personal indignities rendering life burdensome or mental cruelty. I would be happy to take out of the cases in Washington a case which I think illustrates how cruelly some people treated other people before they finally got a divorce. The case I'm thinking of is a man who at a cocktail party did not light his wife's cigarettes. And if that weren't enough, when they left the party and went out to the car, he went directly to his side and opened the door and didn't open hers. Now, can you blame her for suing for divorce? And of course she got it.
The lawyers would find a perfectly legal ground for it.
Now, do you want to know what was really going on?
Yeah.
Before 1970, and that date is magic because that became the time at which no fault divorce, no grounds necessary. You do not need grounds for divorce today. You simply say your marriage is irretrievably broken. That's it. But prior to 1970, the game was played this way. Couples who had arrived at the place where a divorce was to be granted, or to be sought at least, would decide how to split the property. And usually the conversation would be something like this. I would like to have about 75% of all the property, or maybe 85%. Now, if you don't like that, the newspaper is going to be full of what you've been doing. If you're willing to give me the amount of money that I like, it'll be the fact that you didn't light my cigarettes. Which way would you like it? And that's what was going on, of course. Or if you happened to be in a state that was really tough, like New York, where until just about 10 years ago, adultery was the only grounds for divorce. And you had to prove that with pretty good evidence. And the evidence that was used almost always would be photographic. A picture of the man, it was usually the man, seated on a bed, clothed only in underwear, beside some woman clothed only in underwear. And the picture would be introduced into evidence as grounds to prove the adultery. It was regarded as poor form to ever point out to the court that it was always the same room, the same bed, the same woman, in the same underwear, in photograph after photograph after photograph. Because she sat there for her 8 working hours a day while people came in and took off their pants and had their picture taken and went out for lunch. Well, given that kind of a circumstance, I think maybe it's better to be honest. But when you are honest and get over the hypocrisy that was built in, you do something else, and that is there's no longer any grounds for defending. There isn't any grounds for defending against a termination of the status in our marriage laws today. There used to be dandy defenses. For example, forgiveness. If one party committed a fault, like adultery, and the other spouse forgave, then the first spouse could no longer obtain a divorce. Therefore, if you were in doubt about the desirability of remaining married, you never forgave. No lawyer in his right mind would ever advise somebody who had been trying to get a divorce for a few years to try again to reconcile, because an attempt at reconciliation was forgiveness, and there go your grounds, and now you got to wait till you catch the rascal before the camera again. Or connivance. If you could prove that they had scheme together to drum up grounds. Or the one that I like best of all, recrimination. You see, there had to be a innocent party and a guilty party. If one party committed adultery, guilty. If the other one committed adultery, both guilty, neither innocent, no divorce.
Just live with
each other. You're stuck with it, that's right. And because there were 10 grounds for divorce in this state and in many states, you had interesting things like, well, what if one commits adultery twice and the other one only once? Do they balance off? Or what if one is guilty of personal indignities rendering life burdensome and the other one non-support? Do they balance? And our court got to the lovely position where they once decided that a man who was about 185 pounds and hit his wife and she hit him back at about 110 pounds, they didn't balance because he could hit harder than she could. And those were the defenses. And of course, that didn't make very much sense. It made sense only in terms of bargaining power. If you want me to tell the world about what a bum you really are, now what would happen if you took away the bargaining coercive blackmail?
Have a bunch of unemployed lawyers.
You might very well have a bunch of unemployed lawyers.
They always get you to probate.
More cash flows through the divorce court today than flows through probate. Mm-hmm. Think about that one for a while. Well, we did it, of course. There are only 2 states left in the United States today that do not have no-fault divorce now. Only 2 left, and they surely will fall in the next legislative session or so.
What was the average cost like before when they had to litigate a divorce?
Ha.
All right, what was the cost compared to 200? So I'm thinking in terms perhaps it was several thousand. So what you're saying is that the number of divorces today, although the dissolutions, although the fee is less, is what makes the total amount paid to the lawyer so much more than previously.
What you're saying is true. The amount that is charged today for a simple no contest, no custody, no big property, just straight through the courts, is substantially lower than it was before. Now that doesn't mean that the cost of divorces for people who have property has gone down. People have learned how to fight very well about this as well as other things. And there's still the scramble for property and still the scramble for adultery and alimony and for child support and for custody and visitation. And so people can still run the bill up if they like. What percentage of the divorce cases do you think are contested?
What is official contesting?
Where both parties appear before a judge and argue, as contrasted with a case where one party files and the other one either doesn't show up at all or just says it's fine with me and lets it go by default. What percentage of the cases do you think there's really something to litigate?
70?
10.
Why?
10.
10 is a lot closer than 70.
15.
Go in the wrong direction. Okay, I can't answer for the United States, but I've recently finished reading just about 1,200 cases in Washington, scattered over the last few years, to try and answer that question for myself. There is an answer filed in the formal sense in about 12% of the cases, but of course those aren't cases that are argued. You get down to arguments in, well, maybe 4% of the cases.
That many go by default?
By default or by contract agreements. Where the spouses... Cut and dry. Where they work out what's going to happen before they ever get there and take it in to the judge and say, judge, sign it. Let's see, let me ask you another question. In normal civil litigation, other than probate and dissolution, and incidentally, in the courts today in the state of Washington, just over half of all the civil cases filed are divorce actions. But if you take civil litigation other than probate and divorce, how many appeals, how many cases would you have to try before you would get an appeal, one appeal? Yes. You understand my question?
Yeah.
How many cases would you have to try other than probate, other than divorce, before you would get one appeal?
Two.
No, not two. That's not enough. 20, awfully close. About 16. About one out of every 16 civil matters results in an appeal, at least being filed. Now, many of those will never be tried. All right, now, same question for divorces granted. How many divorce decrees will have to be entered, decrees of dissolution, before you get one appeal? I've already told you that only about 4% are litigated. 100, not enough. Not enough.
10,000.
I'll buy that. You're going to have about 1,000 divorce decrees entered before you get one case in which there is enough heat generated to result in an appeal. Now tell me, should we move the dissolution process out of the courts totally? Why are they there?
You mean just have a clerk someplace that says, okay, you want it, you got it, forget about it.
All right, how about that?
Just to give you a new stamp on your marriage license.
City clerk or the county clerk, he sells you the document to get married for practically nothing to begin with. Is it a good solution to reverse the process? Walk in and say, here's my $6.50, I'd like a divorce, and stomp he goes, and
Well, no, because when the judge signs that no contest divorce or the contract divorce or dissolution, he's not just giving a blanket agreement. I mean, he reads the agreements that have been made between the two spouses and decides on whether or not there's merit there and whether or not it's a fair settlement. Isn't that true? So that then
they have agreed how they're going to split their property and who's going to have custody of the children.
So there is a final point there where, I mean, it's true that a lot of that has just been paperwork passing through, but that in order to get to that point and get that simple solution in the judge's chambers, they have to have come to a reasonable agreement before they ever get that far, or he'll throw it out. Isn't that right?
And when you say they have to come to a reasonable decision, do you mean reasonable as they see it, or as the judge sees it?
Reasonable as they agreed upon it to get the thing settled. I never agreed.
Reasonable as the judge sees it.
The judge sees it. Now, those are two different things, obviously.
Yeah, you bet.
It's one thing for a husband and wife to sit down and make a deal and say, you take, say, 80%, I'll take 20%, and you take two children, right. I'll take one.
And that's why you can't totally remove it from the courts.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You may be able to remove part of the responsibility, but there has to be some...
Why take some it to a judge? Why not take it to some good, sound, experienced social worker? Or somebody in the state Fish and Wildlife Department? Why a judge? You know, we've got so many cases pending now, if I may call your attention to that for just a moment. Do you know if you file a civil action in the federal courts today, it'll never be tried? Because things like criminal actions and other special kinds of actions have priority. And so you file your action here and the others come in and take priority and take priority. If you file today, unless Congress gets around to creating some more judges in federal courts, your case will never get to the top of the stack. So it isn't as if we needed more business in the courtroom. So why a judge? You know, why not give it to somebody else? Yeah.
All right. The reason that it seems to me you have to take it to a judge is because everything that gradually, what we've been talking about, that gradually becomes involved and entangled in a marriage relationship are things which are governed by laws. Property is governed by laws. Even children are governed by laws. I mean, you can have them if you choose, but once they're there, they are almost as much the property of the state as they are, you know, their own people. And so...
Think about that some more tomorrow morning, if we may. But
oh, believe me.
There's certainly, you know, there's certainly a tremendous amount of truth in what you're saying. The state has a wardship responsibility for our children.
But it seems to, you know, with almost all of those things that are involved in your life being governed by laws, it seems only natural to take... When you decide to dissolve the relationship that has brought all of those things together, to take it to someone who is knowledgeable of the law and can disperse things equally, or, you know, not equally perhaps, but fairly to both parties as they begin to go in their separate ways.
And if one reneges, then there's a procedure to go and for the other party to get, if there's a contract signed, divorce or disillusionment, and one reneges, then there is a way to get back from the other party.
Enforcement problem.
Yeah.
Okay. At the same time, though, another thing that bothers me, though, is that I don't see that the system that we have now of saying, of giving it, you know, going through the courts entirely and saying, all right, here's legally what we'll do for you. We'll, you know, give this to you and this to you and this to you and this. And then saying, as far as the emotional and spiritual problems that result from this relationship, which has now ended, the result not only for you, two people, but perhaps for children and other people involved, family members involved, we will just, I mean, you're on your own, you know, just go out and don't bother us. It seems to me that there ought to be some kind of cooperative effort to handle both sides of that problem.
But well, we should start in the beginning and start teaching a good marriage to start with thinking, hey, think what you're going to do before you jump into this.
Well, that would be a lot harder to get.
Fascinating problem. And you remember at the beginning of all of this, I said there were four things that I don't believe are related to the narrow topic of the disillusion itself. That's one of them. I agree with you. We're doing a miserable job on marriage formation. Our courtship patterns are poor. That's all you can say for them. But when push comes to shove down at the end, then the question is, you know, why courts? Okay. All right, we've had some suggestion here.
As we live in a society, and society has an interest in marriage, the ramifications of marriage beyond the life of those two people that are involved, and society chooses the law or the judge as a fair representative of society to make that judgment.
Which judgment?
if I may cross-examine you just a little bit.
Never should have answered it, yes.
No. Thank you for answering.
Make a judgment as to whether this should happen. That's not good.
Termination of the status?
Yeah.
That's happened.
That's happened, okay. Okay, then, the various legal and societal involvements of that couple in marriage, and I'm talking about property, children,
records,
and
who
all
owns
the
car,
whole business. Okay,
who owns the land?
The judge is the best person in our society who kind of pulls together the interests of society.
The county auditor, with his records of deeds and sales and transactions, does an awfully good job. And the filing system for bills and notes and mortgages.
But there's something else beside that. It's a whole matter of human relationships. And the judge, the lawyer, so on, is supposed to have some expertise in that field.
Oh,
we have.
I looked the lawyer. Well, they told me that. See, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
We asked a question that we got away from, and the question was, should this agreement that they arrive at be reasonable to them or reasonable to the judge? We got away from that.
Uh-huh.
We have been, yes, I think we did.
Yes.
We have been arguing that it has to be reasonable to the judge, and I disagree with that. I feel that if it is reasonable to them, that and they've looked into all these things, everything we've talked about,
yeah. And
they feel that this is reasonable to them, and all they're asking the judge to do is say, look, Your Honor, we have arrived at an agreement that we both agree to. Will you please sign the document or whatever the judge has to do?
Yeah,
we have a dissent from
yes.
The lady here.
Okay, when you're in the process of divorce, it is a very, very emotional time. And when you want that marriage to end, especially if you are the party who wants that marriage to end, you are willing to give up almost anything to do it.
That's some of the facts
and
of life, though.
Okay, but listen, what if you both want it to end? Okay, we'll say you both want it to end. You're willing to give each other anything. That judge takes a look at that agreement and says, hey, you can't live on that. That's impossible. Now, you've got that. He's there to protect you and to tell you that...
Protect you from yourself?
Yeah.
If necessary.
If necessary, you are not thinking on a clear, coherent level.
May I try to illustrate that?
Absolutely.
With the help of the school of the Graduate School of Social Work a few years ago and some other people, we conducted a study of a good-sized sample of cases which were before the Hanley Court attempting to work out a reconciliation. Now, presumably those cases are a little bit easier than most cases because these people were still talking to each other, at least. They were in the family court. We tested the mental state of these people by five well-recognized psychological instruments to see how they were doing psychologically. And we found that in a trifle over 82% of the cases, at least one of the two people was so depressed and psychologically upset that he or she couldn't conduct normal affairs, couldn't run their business, couldn't take care of their home and their children. They were shot. Now, would anybody enforce a contract made between two people where one of them is almost, at least temporarily?
But it does happen.
Oh, sure it happens. But would you build your law that way? I mean, is that a legitimate objective?
Not if we could, but we're back to where we started, aren't we?
Illustration number two.
Right.
I've known a lot of people in the last 30 years who have had a conversation sort of like this. Our marriage has not worked. One of the reasons it's not worked is because we've never had enough money. We're all starving to death.
Well, isn't that the basis of a lot of marriage failures?
Husband, why don't you take the money that you're making, get a divorce, and the child and I will go on public assistance, and then we'll all have more.
Well, there's too much of that, I agree.
Shall we enforce the contracts that people make without some kind of a review?
But you're getting off into another deep subject again.
Well, indeed I am. It's called dissolution of marriage. The problem is,
shall it be done in one setting or another.
Yeah, but there you go. Of course, I agree with you 100%, but is society able to police something like that and catch the culprits? I sure agree with you, and I'd like to hear a solution, or a part of one.
Maybe the solution is that when people are really desperate and in a financial bind, and we're getting people who are malnourished and growing up to be handicapped in many ways because of inadequate funds, we ought to fund it. Maybe that's good economy. However, that's another problem. The problem I think that I'd like to try in our remaining 4 or 5 minutes before we go to chapel. Could we devise, for example, an administrative process that would do a better job of this? If we're good at anything in the United States, it's administrative processes. We have more administrative agencies than we used to have.
I guess you answered the question there, no.
No. Well, I wonder about that. Marriage is what? It's kind of like a contract of employment. You know, you can't have a good quiet strike anymore without having at least one federal mediator coming in to help settle it. If you strike for over a week, you may get the president himself to intervene. Should we try that? Would some kind of structured mediation, I'm not talking about reconciliation now, we can do that, it seems, with labor and management problems, but maybe the problems of married life are too complex for that. But would some kind of a structured mediation process, an administrative process, at least at the outset, be better than hiring all of my colleagues to do mock battle in a courtroom? Do you know how long the average divorce takes today? No, I posed my question poorly. How long do you think the parties are before the judge?
About
2 minutes. Sometimes for fun I go up with my stopwatch and say, go, and I come.
You're talking about people that have, it's a mutual thing, it's non-contested.
Talking about 96% of them. Mm-hmm. I have watched them brought in that deep, and the judge sits there stamping and signing. That kind of a ritual does not in itself have value. How about divorce by mail?
That would be a lot.
How about a divorce scheme that says people can write in and say we would like to be divorced 3 months from now, and here are the terms of our arrangement, and please have them reviewed, and if there are no objections to this, please sign on page 3 and return it to us.
Well, if it's like the rest of our government, you wouldn't get it for a year and a half.
Maybe that's one reason why we do have them in the courts, but would that be a better system than we have now?
It really would, in a way, because when you do go in front of that, I've been divorced, and I went through I did my own thing. I went to the YWCA, co-op, and, you know, we all discussed it, and it was a good thing. I think I spent $35 doing it. But when I went to, I had to take half a day off of work, and I walked into that courtroom, and I had to sit there until he called my name. I went up and stood, handed him my petition. He said, is your marriage, whatever, you know, can
you... Irretrievably broken at this
date. And I said, yes, and he said, okay, and that was it. And I walked out, and I missed a half a day of work, just to say that.
After
I filed.
Better than fighting about it for a couple days, but worse than being able to do it by mail.
Well,
irretrievably broken, my colleagues in practice have never forgiven me for that terminology. They say they can't spell it. It perhaps is still a better basis than fighting about mock battles. Maybe we ought to go the next step. I'm perfectly serious about this, because at least in my mind, there's justification enough for this so that I would like to propose to the legislature in this state such a process. Kind of a fair hearing, kind of a survey, kind of a screening.
Some of our counties now are running 50% pro se divorces, that is where the people handle their own, as I take it that you do. And there should be more. The average for the state, in this state and other states, is probably up to about 25% pro se now. And I really don't see much reason, personally, for running people through that little charade before a judge, when that could be done by a commissioner or a court officer who could, a clerk, put it bluntly, who could, why miss a half day's work and have your stomach upset? For something where it's cut and dried, and there's no way that the court can possibly finance a careful hearing and a careful review in the courtroom, and you wouldn't want it.
You people are all arguing in my corner. I thank you very much. What I said is you've come to an agreement that's satisfactory to you. You may have taken legal counsel or anything else, and you come to the judge and you were saying, well, he has to review it and so forth. And so now you're saying that it takes him about 15 seconds to do it.
Now we're saying, go ahead, that maybe we want to have somebody who opens the mail and reads it and who checks it out for certain things and then sifts up of that process the relatively few number of cases in which there is something really to enforce or to litigate. Perhaps that is the place where we ought to go to court. Court is probably still the best system that we have for resolving actual conflicts. But I suppose that my message now, in the last 30 seconds, is that's not dissolution of marriage except in very rare instances. So I, for one, would like to see some modifications made, and I thank you for your suggestions. I'll be happy to stand cross-examined.